BBC.
I'm Tom Esselmont from the BBC. I'm in Norway as it prepares to mark its first Christmas since this summer's massacre. I've been meeting Norwegians touched by the tragedy to find out how it's changed their lives and their faith. Heart and Soul spends Christmas in Norway. Online from the 24th of December at bbcworldservice.com.
Films, theatre, music, books. For all the latest news in the world of arts, culture and entertainment, tune into The Strand every weekday.
This is the BBC in Beijing.
Kampala.
Reykjavik.
Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
It's 4 o'clock GMT. This is The World Today from the BBC World Service with Lawrence Pollard and Tim Jenkins.
In the last hour, a tearful North Korean newsreader has announced the death of the country's leader, Kim Jong-il.
News and analysis are still to come on the programme. Also, America urges the Egyptian military not to use violence against protesters in Cairo.
Meanwhile, American troops leave tips into political strife.
This should have been celebrated throughout the country and should have brought people closer to each other. But it seems that the political tensions are really high.
Also coming up, we ask what's become of Kenya's campaign against militants in Somalia.
And why some in Kinshasa are moving to classical music, the capital of African music.
That's all coming up here after the top story.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. In the past hour, state television in North Korea has announced the death of the country's leader, Kim Jong-il. The state news agencies say Kim Jong-il, who was 69, died of a heart attack on board a train on Saturday. Lucy Williamson reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The announcement was made by a newsreader wearing black. She was looking very somber. She was in tears, something that reflects the real shock of this announcement. It had been known for a long time that Kim Jong-il had not been very well. He's been known to have had a stroke, to have received much medical attention over the past few years. But he's been seen more recently looking fit and healthy, travelling internationally. That now has been proved to be wrong. His death will leave a huge hole in North Korea. His presumed successor, his son, Kim Jong-un, hasn't been in place for very long. And there's real concern about what this transition will mean in the country.
Kim Jong-il became the communist world's first dynastic successor in 1994 on the death of his father, Kim Il-sung, who had the title of Eternal President. Nigel Doran looks back on his life.
According to his official biography, Kim Jong-il was born on the 16th of February 1942 in a log cabin at the top of the Korean Peninsula's highest mountain. His birth was heralded by a double rainbow and a bright star, promising he'd become a great general and rule the world. But many believe the truth was more prosaic, and that the son of North Korea's first president, Kim Il-sung, was instead born a year earlier in a Soviet army camp in eastern Russia. After university, he predictably rose fast through the ranks of government. Officially designated his father's successor in 1980, he took power when the elder Kim died in 1994. Despite the world's great interest in him, his country's isolation made him an enigmatic figure. South Korea portrayed him as a frizzy-haired, platform-heeled playboy, whereas the North's own propaganda machine painted him as an international leader of considerable standing. His foreign policy was always erratic. He was accused of state-sponsored terrorism, including the bombing of a South Korean airliner in 1987 that killed more than 100 people. However, overtures to South Korea in 2000 led to a landmark summit with President Kim Dae-jung in June of that year, although initial optimism about better relations on the divided peninsula proved to be short-lived. He also praised China's economic reforms, but refused to implement anything similar back home.
In South Korea, reports say the military has been placed on emergency alert. The South Korean news agency, Yonhap, says the government has convened a meeting of the National Security Council. Asian stock markets have moved lower amid uncertainty about the future of North Korea. World news from the BBC. The US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has appealed to the Egyptian security forces not to use violence against protesters, demanding a faster transition from military rule. 3 days of clashes between police and demonstrators in Cairo have left at least 10 people dead. A photograph taken on Saturday and published around the world shows Egyptian soldiers apparently mistreating a female protester. Jane O'Brien reports from Washington.
Images of a woman being partially stripped by soldiers and dragged along the ground are disturbingly reminiscent of the brutal crackdown against protesters by the regime of Hosni Mubarak, one of the first dictators ousted by the Arab Spring. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she's deeply concerned and has called on all parties to refrain from violence. She urged the Egyptian security forces to respect and protect the rights of all Egyptians and said those who violate those rights should be held accountable.
A mass burial has been organised in the Philippines for dozens of people killed by flash floods on the southern island of Mindanao. More than 650 people were killed by the floods early on Saturday. Kate McGowan is in the city of Cagayan de Oro, where more than 200 people have died.
I've just been to a makeshift mortuary. There's bodies filling three rooms, lots of people coming to have a look at them to see if they're their relatives. And some of them are very difficult to identify, people very confused, people very upset. In fact, there's been so many bodies that just in the mortuary we were at, they've just taken some of the bodies and taken them to a landfill site because there's too many of them for them to cope with.
State television in Iran has shown a video of a man it claims is a spy for the CIA. There's been no immediate response from Washington. In the video, the man says his name is Amir Mirza Hekmati. He says he was sent on a mission to infiltrate a government ministry in Iran. BBC World Service News.
It's 4.06 GMT. You're listening to The World Today from the BBC World Service with Lawrence Pollard and Tim Jenkins.
Now, North Korean state television says the leader Kim Jong-il has died. The news was given in an emotional announcement by a female newsreader soberly dressed in a black tunic.
전체 당원들과 인민군 장병들과 인민들에게 고함. 우리의 전체 당원들과 인민군 장병들과.
Well, let's speak now to Gordon Flake, who is director of the Mansfield Foundation in the US, which works on US-Asian relations. Welcome to the programme, Mr. Flake. First off, tell us about the succession and how this is going to work. We understand that his third son, Kim Jong-un, has been designated as successor. How is that actually managed, do you think?
Well, in many respects, the succession starts today with the passing of Kim Jong-il. There's been an awful lot of speculation for the last year and a half, about his third son, Kim Jong-un. And his third son has indeed been given many high-ranking informal posts. However, he has not been announced formally as a successor. There has been no formal succession plan announced in public or, to most people's knowledge, in private, even among the party members. There's just a lot of reading behind the tea leaves and assumptions. And so in some respects, you know, the key indicators are not going to be coming out for, you know, the coming days or weeks. We've got to see, you know, how the military reacts. We have to see what type of public presence or statement the son takes. Obviously, there's other very influential political figures involved there, too. His uncle, Jang Sung-taek. And others, and so it's going to be a very complicated situation. There is no clear and articulated succession plan. There's just an assumed succession plan in place.
And in terms of policy going forward, is there any reason to expect any change in North Korea's attitude to the outside world, to South Korea, to relations with China?
I mean, first and foremost, I think we can expect a period of kind of hunkering down and focusing inward. We've already seen that to some degree for the last year and a half. But if 1994 was any indication, where the current leader or the recently deceased leader's father, Kim Il-sung, died, you know, they went through basically a 2-year period of kind of hunkering down where, you know, it was quite difficult for them to make decisions. I would anticipate that would be even more difficult this time around, given the lack of a clear succession. You know, at that time, Kim Jong-il was already clearly running the government. At this point, Kim Jong-un is not. He may have begun the process, but, you know, The death of Kim Il-sung in 1994 took place at the end of a 20-year succession process, and now Kim Jong-il's death is really taking place at the very beginning of an intended process, which the success or failure of is clearly not yet known.
Okay, now it seems only a few months ago that Kim Jong-il was seen on a tour in China. How much leverage does China have in the upper echelons in North Korea? Will their influence increase, do you think?
You know, ironically, a lot of the focus in China is going to be not on Kim Jong-un, the son, but on his uncle, Jang Sung-taek, you know, a long-rumored kind of reformer. Kim Jong-il, you know, his younger sister, is married to Jang Sung-taek. They, too, have kind of been presumed to be, you know, the guardians, kind of watching over the succession process and Kim Jong-il. And so if the Chinese were going to be worried about anything, I think they're going to be worried if it does appear that, you know, Jang Sung-taek, you know, their favored kind of candidate or influencer in that process is not taking power. That said, you know, if you look back at 1994, the Chinese, you know, their ability to influence is probably less than we assume, given the fact that what's going to be happening inside North Korea is going to be very much an internal matter at this point.
So you wouldn't expect any changes in sort of diplomatic attitudes in the near future, certainly?
Again, I think those are going to depend on what types of behavior North Korea engages in. You know, the North Koreans over the last 2 years have already deeply strained their relationship, not just, of course, with South Korea and the rest of the world, but also with the Chinese. The Chinese have actually themselves paid a very high diplomatic price for their, you know, unabashed backing of Kim Jong-il, despite, you know, the sinking of the submarine in March of last year, the shelling of an island in South Korea in November of last year. And so, you know, I can imagine that there's probably no country other than South Korea, of course, that is more alarmed by these developments. You know, this is, again, the assumption has been for the last year that the longer Kim Jong-il stayed alive, the more likely we were to have a smooth transition. And obviously that didn't happen. And so this relatively rapid demise of Kim Jong-il, absent a clearly articulated and publicly articulated succession plan or process, really throws a wrench into the works. And I think the Chinese are deeply concerned at this point.
Okay. Many thanks indeed for joining us. Gordon Flake, director of the Mansfield Foundation in the U.S.
Let's just remind us of what exactly has happened by talking to our correspondent in South Korea, Lucy Williamson. Thanks for joining the programme, Lucy. What do we know actually happened? I saw one report that said that the leader had died of overwork, practically.
Yes, the announcement that we heard from state television said that he died of what the newsreader described as mental and physical fatigue. And it happened while he was travelling the country on a train early on Saturday morning, local time. We know that he's had health problems in the past, quite serious health problems, a stroke, for example, perhaps heart disease as well. That he's had international medical care to try and help him through that. And more recently, in fact, he was seen to be looking much healthier. That obviously wasn't the case. And this news that he's suddenly died without any warning, at least from the outside, is going to come as a real shock.
Bit of a delay between the death happening and this announcement. Is that typical in a sort of an opaque society, or has there been a lot of manoeuvring in the background, do you think, now?
The first thing to say is it's very difficult to know what's typical with North Korea. They've only had one transition of power before. But yes, the key issue here is the succession. Who fills these very big shoes that Kim Jong-il had? It's an incredibly centralized system, and he wields an awful lot of both power and also there's a sort of personality cult around him. There's a lot of myth-making around the actual figure of Kim Jong-il. So trying to fill that is a problem. His chosen successor seems to be his son, who was made a four-star general last year, who was appointed to a senior position in the Korean Workers' Party Military Commission, all of which were signs that he was tipped to be a successor. He appeared with his father at state events, things like that. But that's only happened in the past year or so, and he's still very young, still very untried. So the real question now is what happens to that succession? Will it go as planned? Will it go smoothly? Or are there, in fact, many more issues and power struggles to be worked out behind the scenes? That's one reason, perhaps, why the announcement has been delayed. Some of those issues perhaps were being worked out behind closed doors.
And no one more keen for an orderly transition or something regular coming out of this than South Korea itself. What's the reaction there like?
In South Korea, the government has already said they're putting the country on high alert. All military units have been put on a higher alert. The president has called an emergency security meeting to discuss the implications of this. North and South Korea never signed a peace treaty 60 years ago after their war. And relations between the two have been particularly tough under the current administration. The president, Lee Myung-bak, has taken a very tough line against the North. That hasn't always meant for a calm relationship. So I think there are going to be many countries around the world who are sort of watching and waiting to see where this latest transition leaves them and how smoothly it goes.
Lucy, keep us posted. Lucy Williamson there in Seoul.
No one's going to be looking as closely as South Korea and, of course, the Chinese as well. As we mentioned, the leader, the dear leader, as he was known, Kim Jong-il, was last seen in public on a tour by train to China. The Chinese have been seen as the state with the most influence on the North Korean leadership, and Beijing will be watching events very closely. Our correspondent there is Martin Patience. We can talk to him now. Martin, what's been the initial response?
Well, it has been announced on Chinese state media, almost followed on exactly after it was announced on state TV in North Korea. There's as of yet to be any official reaction to the death of Kim Jong-il or indeed about the succession plans. But certainly, as you were pointing out there, China will be very concerned about what's happening in North Korea. China is North Korea's main ally. And the one thing that Beijing wants more than most is it wants stability. It does not want to see problems with this transition, which could lead possibly to some kind of collapse.
And what exactly is their influence and leverage? Because North Korea, obviously known for being very prickly in all its diplomatic relationships, presumably there must be a lot of economic influence that the Chinese have on North Korea.
Well, that's right. It comes down to money. When North Korea has got a problem, it comes to Beijing. We've seen in recent years that Kim Jong-il has increasingly come to Beijing, or indeed China, to hold talks with senior officials. The main reason he's doing that is because he's got nobody else to speak to. From Beijing's perspective, however, the behaviour of Kim Jong-il has become something of an embarrassment. Certainly, China wants to be seen as a rising power. Wants to be seen as a mature state on the world stage, and certainly in recent months, certainly over the past year, there's been a great deal of embarrassment over the antics of Kim Jong-il, that attack, for example, in South Korea, the sinking of the warship. So certainly Beijing does have control, it does have influence in terms of money, but that said, Kim Jong-il certainly didn't always listen to Beijing, and the big question will be whether or not the people in charge now, and indeed his son, who's his likely successor, Kim Jong-un, will listen to Beijing as well.
Many thanks indeed. Martin Patience in Beijing.
BBC World Service, you're listening to The World Today. Well, the timing couldn't have been more stark, really. Just hours after the last American troops left Iraq, a major split emerged in the country's fragile national unity government. Let's hear more about that. Our correspondent in Baghdad is Jim Muir.
There is now a very open rift in the kind of ruling national unity government, which basically is apparently sort of falling apart. The cabinet itself so far has held together, but a major component of parliament has walked out. That's the faction headed by Ayad Alawi, known as the Iraqiya bloc, which basically is the repository of all the Sunni votes, practically all the Sunni votes in the country. So they've pulled out of parliament. There's been apparently a move to slap an arrest warrant on the vice president of the country, Tariq al-Hashmi, who's the senior Sunni figure in the country, politician, accusing him or certainly some of his bodyguards of taking part in bomb attacks quite recently in Baghdad. And there's a move by the prime minister to basically impeach one of his own deputies, Saleh al-Mutlaq, another very senior Sunni politician, before parliament. So it's a very serious rift with very strong sectarian overturns, whereby the Shiite majority prime minister, Mr. Maliki, seems to be going for the top political Sunni leadership, and it brings to a head a lot of very strong tensions between them. Now, people had been expecting trouble when the Americans left, some kind of political squabbling breaking out, but some, including the foreign minister, Hoshyar Zebari, were surprised by quite how quickly it's happened. Here's what he had to say.
Well, unfortunately, it has come much sooner than many people anticipated. And after a successful visit to Washington, after the withdrawal of American forces, this should have been celebrated throughout the country and should have brought people closer to each other. to think about the future. But it seems that the political tensions are really high. And in the next few days, I believe there would be concerted efforts by all to try to contain the new political crisis in order to be able to stand on our feet. Now we are sovereign, we are independent, we have enormous resources to develop this country, but it needs political consensus and participation.
How serious is this crisis that you have now with?
It is serious because some of the key figures of Al-Iraqi list, in fact, has been named publicly and so on. And this should have not gone to the media at first hand. It should have been properly investigated.
People like the vice president, for example.
The vice president, the deputy prime minister, let's say, others. Relations has always been tense between Iraqi and the National Alliance or Tahalif Watani. But unfortunately, they have come to the fore, you see, with the day of the American troops departure.
Foreign Minister Hoshea Zebari talking to Jim Muir in Baghdad there.
Coming up to 20 minutes past 4 GMT. This is The World Today from the BBC. Now back to our top story. The news that State TV in North Korea has announced the death of the country's leader, Kim Jong-il. The stock markets in Asia have fallen on the news of Kim's death, with investors worried about potential instability in the region. Our business reporter, Linda Duffin, is here. Bring us up to date, Linda.
Well, Korean shares fell as much as 5% on the news. The Korean won fell 1.8%. Financial markets worried, of course, about the instability that a leadership transition in the North could bring to the region as a whole. South Korea, I think, will be worrying that investors could withdraw money from its economy. The extent of the impact is hard to gauge this early, but the South doesn't want any instability in the North, so analysts are thinking it'll probably work to extend its cooperation efforts.
Now, we're very lucky that you're around the office because you've actually been to North Korea, which makes you a rare creature indeed. What's it like? And also, of course, what's the state the economy's in?
Well, I have to say it was a very, very surreal and bizarre experience. You can only visit North Korea as a rule, unless you get permission from the government, by going in from the south on day trips. And this is all to get hard currency into the country. It costs $200. You get on a bus. You are monitored every inch of the way. You're watched every inch of the way. People follow you around. It's a very strange experience. You're going on this bus through really beautiful countryside, but the buildings are shabby, the fields lie fallow, the economy appears to be on the point of collapse, in fact. You're banned from talking to North Koreans or even taking photographs from the bus window. Policemen standing to attention all the way along the line. Apparently, I was told when I asked for our protection, although it wasn't clear what they were protecting us from, we visited a local beauty spot, a shrine, a temple, and then they gave us this slap-up lunch, which was a very uncomfortable experience because, of course, North Koreans are still suffering from massive food shortages. There were famines there in the 90s, up to 1 million people said to have been killed. And we virtually bypassed, we went past, but we weren't allowed to go inside the Kaesong Industrial Complex. Now, that's built by South Korean companies. It employs around 27,000 North Korean workers. And the relationship between the North and South goes up and down. Sometimes it's closed, sometimes it's open. But essentially, the South gets cheap labour and the North gets hard currency and modern technology. And I think that is a relationship that the South will perhaps want to see continue.
Many thanks indeed. Linda Duffin, I have to say one of the weirdest films I've ever seen is Pulgasari, which is the North Korean version of Godzilla, featuring a Japanese gentleman in a rubber suit who goes around eating metal to protect the peasants from their capitalist oppressors. A real cracker. 23 minutes past 4 GMT. This is The World Today from the BBC.
Absolutely fascinating. What is happening to Kenya's military operation into neighbouring Somalia? It all began with a lot of fanfare in October with the aim of driving out Al-Shabaab militants from areas near the Kenyan border. The Kenyan army's vowed it'll pursue Al-Shabaab deep into Somalia, but the operation's proving rather expensive. Al-Shabaab has avoided direct engagement with Kenyan forces, and the supportive mood back in Kenya, well, that might be changing. Let's speak now to someone who's just returned from southern Somalia, Daniel Howden, who's a reporter for the UK's independent newspaper. Thanks for joining us, Daniel. Tell us how, then, the Kenyan forces are now being bogged down.
Daniel, well, Kenya moved in, as you said, with fanfare.
about 2 months ago. But in actual fact, they've made very little progress in terms of moving forward since the first 2 weeks elapsed. They've been bogged down first with heavy rains. Excuses were made that there was too much mud to move forward. Now it appears that there's not enough money. And everything is really at a standstill.
Is this a classic mistake of sending a regular army in against guerrilla operations? They can melt away into the local populace. Was this badly planned from the start on the Kenyan side?
Well, several commentators that I've spoken to from the Kenyan side have said that the best way to describe the overall strategy was disastrous. Moving in just as heavy rains were beginning to occur, there seems to have been an assumption on the Kenyan side that once they made a military move, there would be financial support from outside powers. That's so far not been forthcoming. There's been a lot of moral support for Kenya, but they've been forced to pay for the operations themselves, which is something which they can no longer afford and have had to appeal to the African Union to help support them.
And in the meanwhile, public support is declining back in Kenya.
Well, it began with embedded reporters from the Kenyan side wearing national flag T-shirts and some of them playing around in ammo belts. The war was very much a breathless and exciting event, the first foreign war that Kenya has fought, on all of the evening bulletins. And this morning in Kenya's newspapers, you have to go very deep into them to find any mention at all of the war. And in fact, some of the more controversial reports of casualties and of problems on the front are now being quite deliberately buried.
Daniel Howden, thanks very much for telling us that there.
Coming up to 26 minutes past 4 GMT, the portrait emerging of Václav Havel, the former president of Czechoslovakia, who's just died, is as complicated and interesting as his life was. An intense intellectual and a joke teller. A man prepared to go to jail for years as a dissident and a playwright, and also a man very happy to party.
Now, one man who actually met Václav Havel many years before he was even famous on a large scale was Timothy Garton. Timothy Garton Harrison, here he is talking to me now.
I drove up to northern Bohemia where he had a farmhouse, and as I came round the corner I saw there was a secret police card blocking the gate, so I hastily pulled up in the woods and found my way, almost like the agent of Western imperialism, through the damp woods and in through his garden and tapped on the window. He looked a bit surprised but delighted and greeted me very warmly. He was wearing a T-shirt, I remember, which said, "Temptation is great," and Temptation was his latest play, and we sat and talked for most of the day about his writings, about his experiences in prison, where he'd had to wrestle with a dreadful prison governor who saw himself as a little Hitler and wanted to censor everything he wrote. It was an unforgettable day with one of the great dissidents of our time.
Some intellectuals can be a bit dry. He was far from that.
He was absolutely, and I think almost what I most remember about him was his tremendous sense of humour, which was constantly bubbling over, even when he was weighed down with the cares of office. I remember him taking me to see the original torture chamber in the historic Prague castle, where he now sat as president, and saying to me, "I think we will use it for negotiations."
I saw some of that sense of humour, I think, when I rang him up in the early days of my career and I said to him, you know, could you give us an interview? And he said, in perfect English, "I don't speak English." I got the sense also of a man who was frenetic during those days and partly stunned by the events which he partly caused.
You know, I was lucky enough to be with Havel and the others in the bowels of the Magic Lantern Theatre for most of the Velvet Revolution. And of course, it was for them, it wasn't a dream come true, it was beyond their dreams coming true. It was extraordinary, it was a fairy tale. Here was this tiny, isolated group, and suddenly there were 300,000 people on Wenceslas Square waving their keys, making the sound like Chinese bells. And he knew that he had been carried away. And he said wryly, when the first buttons appeared saying Havel for president, he said, but I want to go back and be a writer. But he knew that that was not his fate, that he had to do what history and his country asked of him and become the first president of a free Czechoslovakia since the Second World War.
BBC.
What will be the names, places, phrases and faces that will define the year ahead? This is Owen Bennett-Jones, and I'll be joined by some of the BBC's top journalists to find out what they think will be making the news in 2012. The Arab Spring, the Euro crisis, presidential elections in the United States, Russia, France and China. Joining me will be the BBC's special correspondent, Lise Doucette, our North America editor, Mark Mardell, economics editor, Paul Mason, and diplomatic correspondent, James Robbins. Be better prepared for 2012 with BBC Correspondents Look Ahead. Online from the 31st of December at bbcworldservice.com.
Get a global perspective, detailed, in-depth and daily. The World Today has reports, interviews and expert analysis. 7 days a week from the BBC.
This is The World Today from the BBC World Service.
Today's programme. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il has died.
America urges the Egyptian military to stop its violence against protesters in Cairo.
As American troops leave Iraq, has the occupation marked the end of traditional warfare?
And we ask if the Chinese property market has peaked.
All that and more in The World Today. First, the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. North Korea has announced the death of its leader, Kim Jong-il. A newsreader on state television, dressed in black, wept as she read the announcement. North Korea's news agency said Kim Jong-il, who was 69, died of a heart attack on board a train on Saturday. He'd been unwell for some time. A BBC correspondent in South Korea says Kim Jong-il's son and presumed successor, Kim Jong-un, hasn't been in place for very long, and there's real concern about what the transition of power will mean. A funeral for Kim Jong-il will be held in the North Korean capital Pyongyang on the 28th of December. Kim Jong-il inherited power from his father, Kim Il-sung, who died in 1994. In South Korea, reports say the military has been placed on emergency alert, although a defense official in Seoul said South Korea hadn't detected any signs of unusual movement by the North's military. The South Korean news agency, Yonhap, says the government has convened a meeting of the country's National Security Council. In Japan, a spokesman says the Prime Minister has set up a crisis management team on North Korea. In Washington, a White House spokesman said the US was in close touch with both Tokyo and Seoul. Stock markets in Asia have fallen amid uncertainty about the future of North Korea, which has a controversial nuclear program. Other news, the American Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has appealed to the Egyptian security forces not to use violence against protesters, demanding a faster transition from military to civilian rule. Mrs. Clinton said she was deeply concerned at the situation in Cairo, where 3 days of clashes, which began on Friday, left at least 10 people dead. State television in Iran has shown a video of a man it claims is a spy for the CIA. There's been no immediate response from Washington. The authorities in the southern Philippines are struggling to bury the bodies of hundreds of people killed by flash floods. More than 200 people died in the city of Cagayan de Oro. BBC News.
Listening to The World Today from the BBC World Service with Lawrence Pollard and Tim Jenkins.
North Korea is a country which has been defined by the personality of its eternal president, its dear leader, Kim Jong-il. And now that leader is no more. So what next? Joining us from Seoul in South Korea is Michael Breen, Kim Jong-il's biographer. Welcome to the programme, Michael. First of all, he had, didn't he, a stroke in 2008. We know the transition mechanism is a little bit opaque, but was Pyongyang ready for this shock, do you think?
Well, it wasn't at the time. That's 3 years ago he had a stroke, but it was only last year that his son was, third son was named as the successor. And at the time that was seen as a rather sort of rapid shoving onto the stage of the next leader. So I think everyone thought at that time, okay, his health is not good. So frankly, this is not too unexpected. It always comes as a bit of a surprise, this sort of thing, but it's not unexpected. By the way, let me correct you in your introduction. The eternal president is Kim Il-sung, the founding father, and Kim Jong-il's father. So Kim Jong-il himself was the second leader. He's the dear leader. And so now we're going to have the third one.
The handover process is going to be quite opaque, as I say, but we can expect what? Huge funeral arrangements now. I think the funeral is set for December the 28th. The whole nation will be involved, I guess.
Yeah, I think the idea here is North Koreans have to demonstrate their sort of loyalty and their emotion. Koreans are very emotional people, outwardly emotional, so you're going to see a lot of crying and shrieking and so on. I think a lot of it will be forced. But that's going to, this is going to occupy the attention of everybody for the next week or two at least.
And people will expect there to be, what, a possibility of a change in the way that North Korea operates. Is that realistic?
Well, true. I mean, people will expect it. Whether anything will change, though, is, in my opinion, unlikely at this point. Barring the surprising event, I think we can see more of the same.
And why is that, Michael Breen? Is it because the regime itself is in control rather than any individual, or is just desperate to hang on to power?
Well, I think North Korea, the elite in North Korea, is held together by a shared concern. This is a country that, frankly, shouldn't exist. You know, it was created in opposition to South Korea. South Korea has won the rivalry. There's very little justification for it to exist, but it does. And the elite there will want to keep it that way. So they're not going to start fighting among themselves.
How does the rest of the world react to this? Has the rest of the world just got to sit back and see what happens? Is there any chance of influencing events in Pyongyang?
No, not really. We all think the Chinese have a lot of influence, but I don't think they do. We've just got the biggest concern for the neighbours and for those of us here in South Korea is instability. This is what we're mainly concerned about. So for as long as they're stable, there's not going to be any interference. No one's going to interfere in the interest of democracy and human rights. Stability is going to be the thing on everybody's mind, and I think that's what we're going to see. I think it'll just be a stable process. Now, a few years down the road, there may be there's uncertainty there, but for now, I think it's in their interest for it to see a stable succession take place.
Is there any point in assessing the legacy of Kim Jong-il?
Well, the legacy. Here's the most horrible country in the world, frankly. He inherited it. We all thought that he might open up. What did he do? He drove it into the ground. I mean, there was a famine in the 1990s that killed an estimated 10% of the people. This is a famine in Northeast Asia. You know, China, Japan, South Korea, in the middle of that circle, a famine. This is thanks to Kim Jong-il. What he did achieve was survival, and he turned his state into a nuclear power. I guess they can be proud of that, but for what it's worth. But frankly, this is a man who has not done his people any favours at all.
Michael Breen, thanks for talking to us. That's Michael Breen, Kim Jong-il's biographer there.
Coming up to 4:38, GMT. American troops have left Iraq, a major moment for Iraq, which has plunged straight away into political uncertainty. And also a moment for America, which now can mull the lessons from Iraq about how best to project American power and protect its interests around the world. As part of that debate, it's being suggested that the 2003 invasion could be the last war between states that we could ever see. The nature of war is changing, that's the argument, and it's also killing fewer people than ever before. That is the additional, rather surprising claim made by Professor of International Relations Joshua S. Goldstein. So, I asked the professor, what are the reasons for the reduction in so-called traditional wars?
I see three big reasons for it. One is that over the course of history, people's norms and ideas about war have changed. So it used to be glorious to go fight and you'd prove your manhood and so forth. And now we don't think about it that way. We talk about defense, not war. And we're always, you know, it's the last resort and so forth. So even when we go to war, we think about it differently now. And we care about civilians in a way that we didn't before. The second big reason is that as the world has become more prosperous and depends on trade more, war doesn't fit into making money anymore. It used to be you could conquer land and that would get you wealth from agriculture. And now you have to trade to get wealth, and war doesn't help you with that. The third big reason is that the international community has developed, and the United Nations in particular, so that we have new tools to handle international conflicts short of war and to try to reduce and extinguish wars when they do break out. So peacekeeping. And the UN itself, do you know that no member of the United Nations has ever gone out of existence from being conquered, which is kind of a new thing historically. So that's a good record for the UN and one that we'd hope to continue in the future.
If there are practical reasons for why people won't go to war, are you ever going to eliminate a kind of like a deeper genetic, almost a need in humans, it seems, to commit violence for one another? I mean, little boys are still going to want to play soldiers, aren't they?
Yes. I don't think we will ever eliminate war from human nature or from our potentials that we have biologically. It's very deep-seated in human nature. I'm not one that says we're peaceful by nature and just nice, and that's why war will end. On the other hand, human nature also gives us faculties that allow us to change and to learn, to restrain our impulses, to feel empathy for other people and so forth. And these are also part of our biology. So I see that what once happened with cannibalism or dueling or slavery could also happen with war in the future.
So there are better ways also for nation states to prosecute their interests than doing something as clumsy as invading another country.
That's right. And certainly after the experience we just had in Iraq since 2003, I don't think countries will be jumping to use that resort as their first line of getting what they want, because it didn't work very well.
And I suppose part of the Iraq experience as well is that it morphed into, is it the future of war, insurgency, terrorism, the sort of the asymmetrical conflict that we've been covering in it, in all its horrors for the past few years?
Yes, that is the future, evidently, because throughout the world today, nowhere are these big national armies fighting each other. Anywhere in the world right now, all the wars that are left are civil wars. A government on one side, an insurgent force on the other side. And they can be very nasty and brutal, but they tend to be smaller scale than these big national wars.
But when it comes to looking at conflict and violence and deaths caused around the world, do you have graphs that tell you which way it's going? Is it possible that deaths from war are actually decreasing, or deaths from conflict are decreasing? What is that broadest possible picture that you can give us?
So the number of people killed in wars worldwide, and this is direct battle deaths, military and civilians, not counting cholera epidemics and this kind of thing, spin-offs, which are also important but harder to measure. But the direct deaths from violence, half in this decade what they were in the 1990s, a third what they were in the Cold War, and of course about a hundredth what they were during the World War. So a pretty dramatic trend downward in the numbers.
And is that something that leads to an end point where, I mean, it seems impossible, but is it philosophically possible where violence decreases to such a degree that you can kind of say, well, there is no more war? I mean, that's never going to happen, is it?
Well, not right away, that's for sure. I see it more as an asymptotic slope that's going down but flattening out closer and closer to zero. And
right, you're going to have to explain that for us.
A curve that's approaching zero but never quite reaching
okay.
zero. So it may be that we'll never have peace on Earth, the end of violence, harmony and understanding, but we could have a reduction of war to the point that it does not dominate our lives the way it has historically.
Well, that's Professor Joshua S. Goldstein of the American University. And if you want to find out more about his thesis of the end of war, go to winningthewaronwar.com.
Now, I don't want to scare you, but we know that the global economy is in trouble. And the bad news is that the Chinese property market is also in trouble. And that's quite bad news. Just remember the effect of problems with the American property market and the ripple effects from that. So how worrying is it that China's property market has developed a bubble? Well, from Beijing, our correspondent Martin Patience reports.
You only have to look at the Beijing skyline to realise how key construction has been to the country's boom. As the gleaming skyscrapers, the fancy shopping malls, the towering apartment blocks have all gone up, property prices have increased five times in the last decade in cities across China. But in recent months, those in the property sector have gone from giddy to, well, a bit gloomy. And that's because prices are beginning to drop and sales are down sharply. At a government office, people come to register the sale or the purchase of an apartment. One woman told me she'd have got a lot more money if she'd sold 6 months ago. The big question that many are asking here is how far could China's property market fall? The vice president of one of the country's biggest real estate agents, Hu Jinhui, believes it could drop by as much as 30%. He says that some investors are beginning to panic.
China's property prices are so high that they no longer make sense. We are seeing investors move out of the private property sector to the commercial sector or overseas. Smaller developers face becoming bankrupt. The property sector will remain a major sector in Chinese investment, but the rules of the game have changed.
With rising prices, property was always seen as a safe bet for many Chinese. A lending boom following the global financial crisis in 2008 pushed up prices further. Since last year, however, the authorities have taken measures to cool down the property market, such as restricting the number of properties individuals can buy. These measures are now biting. But Patrick Chovanec, an economist based in Beijing, warns that the downturn could extend far beyond the property market.
Property prices underline almost all of the lending that takes place in the Chinese economy. And the Chinese economy has been driven over the past few years by lending, just like in the United States or just like in Europe. The ramifications of the housing market, either rising or falling, extend far beyond just construction and that small portion of the economy.
But property prices aren't just about economics, it's also about confidence. For millions of Chinese, owning their own home has become a symbol of success, that things are getting better. And where do they come to furnish their new homes? Well, naturally, IKEA. One of the shoppers told me that a drop in prices is healthy as it makes homes more affordable. But if prices fall too much, he said, then it could spell trouble for the wider economy. There may not be outright panic yet, but there is concern. The worry is that the foundations of the world's second largest economy may not be as firm as many thought.
Safe as houses? No, maybe not. Martin Patience there in Beijing.
4:47 GMT, time for the sport. Manchester City are once again 2 points clear at the top of the English Premier League. We're joined by Steve Crossman. Steve, it's not an enormous gap, and one of Manchester United's players, I gather, thinks they can close it pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's right. Johnny Evans is confident that United will do it, so much so that he's predicting a possible change at the top within a calendar month. Evans was part of the team that sealed a 2-0 win over Queen's Park Rangers to briefly take Sir Alex Ferguson's side to the Premier League summit on Sunday. The defender says that watching their neighbours win the league would be the worst possible scenario, and the next few weeks could prove pivotal.
It's a big period coming up for us, and I think, you know, if we win all our games in this, you know, Christmas period, we give ourselves a very good chance of being at the top of the league. You know, because they'll have tough games coming up, and I think the fixture list at the minute, you know, ours is probably looking a bit better. In the past, maybe if Chelsea or Arsenal or Liverpool had won it, you know, it's a bit of a distance, maybe not so Liverpool, but, you know, with Man City, if they win it, you know, it's in your faces every day, and that's something that, you know, adds that extra bit of, you know, bite to the Premier League, and we'll hopefully we'll come out on top.
Well, City did return to the top of the league on Sunday evening. They beat Arsenal 1-0 in a contest that, in fairness, was much easier on the eye than the scoreline suggests. David Silva got the only goal for Roberto Mancini's side. The City manager was relieved to pick up a vital 3 points.
That was important because Manchester United are doing a good season, like Manchester City. We are strong, they are strong, but we know that the season is long. Could be also during the season that we can go in second position. But we know it's important to stay on the top in the end.
Well, it's not Arsenal nor Chelsea who sit third behind the two Manchester clubs now. It's Tottenham Hotspur. They inflicted a first defeat on new Sunderland boss Martin O'Neill at White Hart Lane, thanks to substitute Roman Pavlyuchenko, who scored the only goal of the game. Finally, the International Boxing Federation have ruled there will be no immediate rematch for Amir Khan against Lamont Peterson following his controversial loss in Washington last weekend. An IBF statement said that we found no discrepancies that would affect the outcome or the result of the fight. Khan was penalised for pushing during the contest. His camp now have until Tuesday if they wish to lodge a formal complaint against the verdict.
Many thanks indeed. With the sports news, Steve Crossman.
A reminder of the main news, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has died. A newsreader on state television wept as she made the announcement. The South Korean and Japanese governments are holding emergency sessions now.
Coming up to 10 minutes to the hour, a young woman in Bangladesh whose husband allegedly chopped off her fingers has told the BBC that she's trying to use her weaker hand to carry on with her studies. Hawa Akhtar Jui says her husband Rafiqul was angry because she was attending college and defying his orders. She's been speaking to our Bangladesh correspondent Ambarasan Etirajan, who joins us now. Ambarasan, what exactly happened to this woman?
The couple, the Hawa Akhtar Jui and Rafiqul Islam, they got married about 3 years ago, and later on he went to the United Arab Emirates to work as a migrant labourer. Meanwhile, Hawa Akhtar Jui, she finished her school intermediate and then she wanted to join a college. She said that her husband did not want her to enroll in any college, probably because he was not that much educated. He finished only 8th standard and they had differences during the conversations over the phone. And earlier this month, she was asked to come to a relative's house in the capital, Dhaka. And to a surprise, she found her husband, and she thought he has come back with some gifts for her. And then later on, he told her to come to a room, next room. And the both of them had a discussion there. And then what happened? This is what she had to say.
He took me to another room and I asked him, where is the necklace you've bought me? He blindfolded me and put tape over my mouth. He then tied my hand to the table and chopped off my fingers with a meat cleaver.
And Barasan, give us an idea, is domestic violence a big issue in Bangladesh?
It is indeed a big issue here. We keep reading in the newspapers and other, as well as the television channels, carrying reports of women, housewives being beaten or even sometimes acid thrown on their face. Even girls, in the college girls, if someone doesn't accept any proposal from a boy, they get acid thrown on their face. There are a variety of domestic violent incidents. A few months ago, one of the professors in a college, and she was beaten by her husband. She lost her eyesight. She was a Fulbright scholar, and later on she migrated to Canada. So it has been happening, and this particular incident shocked the country because of the brutal nature. So how big is the problem? Sarah Hussain is a human rights lawyer.
The problem of violence against women, including domestic violence, is pervasive across Bangladesh and affects probably the vast majority of women and girls. As far as we know, only 2% of women actually seek any kind of legal protection. The justice system is too often seen as just an avenue for further injustice for victims and survivors of violence. In addition, there's a real culture of violence where abuse and violence is seen as the only response to any kind of conflict. That particularly affects women.
Ambarasan, following up on this story, what's happened to the husband in this case?
Following a complaint from the father of Jui, the girl, he has been arrested. Now he's in custody. Police say that they will be pressing charges against him. He's facing charges of permanent disfiguration and he could face life in prison.
Many thanks indeed. Our Bangladesh correspondent, Ambarasan Etirajan.
7 minutes to 5 o'clock GMT. One of the award-winning photographs of the year at the World Press Photo Awards is from the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's nothing to do with the political turmoil in the country, but instead it shows a cello player concentrating hard on her instrument amidst the noise and bustle of a vast Kinshasa market. She's one of the hundreds of amateurs who make up the Orchestre Kambanguiste. Will Ross reports.
The sound of Congo, it's heard everywhere and is like the country's pulse. But in Kinshasa, down a dirt road with potholes that had turned into lakes, my ears were in for a surprise. Meet 24-year-old university student Bruce Makusanga with his viola. He says at first his friends mocked him for breaking the musical mould, but that's all changed now.
A lot of people appreciate to see a young guy like me learning classical music and playing also classical music. There is a kind of esteem that they have towards me.
And you said it's your passion. Where did you pick up the passion for classical music?
When I was young, my father had a radio, and he used to put foreign music, classical music. I used to listen to that, and it's created a kind of passion to me. I decided myself when I grew up that I had a kind of determination to learn also classical music myself.
Bruce headed across town for a rehearsal with the orchestra set up by his church. Away from the hectic traffic by the River Congo, it was time for Handel's Water Music. Lupeta Steve, you're the Secretary General of the Kimbanguist Philharmonic Orchestra. Tell me, where do you get your instruments from?
Maestro went to China to buy our instruments. It was in 2006.
The leader of the orchestra went to China and brought all the instruments back.
Yes.
That must have been quite a day when he arrived with all these instruments.
A fantastic day, yes. It was a big day for us, because we were waiting for these instruments during 3 years.
And you had nothing to play in that time, or you were borrowing?
Just to sing, without instrument, to play without instruments.
So for 3 years you were all singing, and nobody was playing any instruments?
Nobody.
Many people would think that Congo is a very difficult place to live. It's hard to earn a living. So they'll be surprised to know that people have the time and the energy and the money to organize playing classical music.
Yeah.
But this is a sign of determination by your musicians.
Yeah. Situation is not, for this time, is not good in DRC. But I think one day Congolese will be happy if our governments try to do their best and help us to ameliorate our situation.
So help the people rather than themselves.
Yes. They have to stop with corruption. They have to think for people.
And tell me what your dream is. Where would you like to play one day?
We like to play one day in Vienna. Vienna, yes.
In Austria.
In Austria. One day, if I can play there, it will be a big day for, not for me, but even for the orchestra.
Will Ross and the Sweet Sound of Success, the Orchestre Kambanguiste there in Kinshasa. Let's return to our main story this today. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has died. Let's get the latest from the news wires. William Edmondson with us. What are they saying?
Yes, Timothy, lots of agency material, as you can imagine, coming in minute by minute. Summary really today, right now, of how the international community is reacting at the moment. The Japanese Prime Minister has set up a crisis management team on North Korea. In South Korea, as you can imagine, they're watching things very closely, but they say at the moment there's no unusual North Korean military activity at the moment. The South Korean president, nonetheless, has ordered all government workers on an emergency footing. And the White House has said it remains committed to stability on the Korean Peninsula and is watching things closely.
Keeping us up to date, William Edmondson. Plenty more here on The World Today.